Hi everyone, I'm Scott Brown, and before we dive into today's lessons I learned in law, I just wanted to tell you about our friends over at Beamery. Beamery is a real game changer in the world of talent management, so HR and talent teams should definitely take note. It is trusted by the likes of Accenture, McKinsey, AstraZeneca and Uber to name a few. Now this is a great piece of recruitment technology, which is an AI-powered talent platform that will enable you to hire candidates faster, develop the skills of your existing workforce, and increase employee retention. With Beamery, you'll have a complete understanding of your workforce's skills and capabilities, and it's all about building an agile and future-proof team. So check it out. Head over to their website at beamery.com. Hi, welcome to Lessons I Learned in Law, Series 5. This is the OG of Legal Recruitment Podcasts. Every episode I'm joined by a top mind from the legal profession, and hopefully they're sharing three key lessons that they've learned in law that are aspirational to our listeners and give you a bit of a track record as to how they've got to the position that they're in today. I'm delighted to be joined by Francesca Porter. Hi, Francesca.
Hi, delighted to be here. Feeling a little bit like a legal Adele today.
Oh, well, give us a song.
you wouldn't want to hear my thing.
Francesca is currently general counsel at Onfido, which is an AI software business which is focused on biometrics and facial identity. I was reading recently has gone through an acquisition, which is very exciting.
Yeah, we only announced that yesterday, yeah. So very excited about that.
Amazing. Has that been full on recently?
It was. I mean, M&A, like whether it's big, small, medium, is always really time intensive for the lawyers, but also just great learnings. And what we've acquired is a really privacy-centric, amazing company with some really cutting-edge technology. So we're really excited to see what we can do with that.
Nice one. And then the work starts here on the integration.
Exactly.
And so we'll hear more about Francesca's role, and she sits on the Execco and Fido as well, which is a real something that a lot of lawyers aspire to do. So we'll be interested to hear about how that came around and how you support the Exec. But we'll jump into lesson one.
I love this idea, this concept of the three lessons I learned, and I had to have a really good think about the key lessons. The first I'd say is that smart people simplify. That's a phrase that many of us will have heard. But when it comes to law, there are lots of complex concepts. And when you're working in a law firm, getting your head around that technical detail is an amazing discipline. But then when you go in-house, being able to take that technical detail and turn it into actionable insights and concrete steers is what's really important. So I've seen some absolutely incredible lawyers come up with very detailed technical papers, words of advice that don't actually have an impact on the business. And we had our legal offsite recently, and we were talking about the differences between advising and influencing. Now, you can give your advice and it can be perfection, but if nobody's listening, if you're not able to drive changes within the business and you're not able to influence, then how meaningful are you in your role? So smart people simplify. Back to the lesson. The power of lawyers is not only to understand and to articulate the legal position, but it's to effectively convey a message to key business stakeholders that you want to be heard and to drive influence. And the more simple you can make the message, the more data that you can use to substantiate it and speak in the language of your stakeholders, the more impactful you can be.
Yeah, excellent. Where did you first learn that? Was that in practice or in-house, in your roles in-house?
I had this interesting conversation recently with this wonderful Fido resource group within our company called All Early. Right. And it's all about early career journeys. And one of the questions that came up was around mentors. We were talking about the importance of mentors and where you learn things. Yeah. And I would say that when it comes to learnings, I'm a bit of a beggar, a borrower and a thief. I have mentors all over because I look at everyone and try and see how they're managing to be impactful. Yeah. And with the smart people simplify, one of the most impactful people that I've worked with was a privacy lawyer. And he's ex-Google, and he wrote in the Google style of writing. Mm. And he was able to divine very, very complex concepts into very simple one pages that were scalable, getting it out of his head and effectively onto a one pager that could then be shared on and on and on and on, so that he wasn't just in a corner giving very complex advice. He was conveying a message across a large number of people. And so, yeah, it was really through watching his writing style and his impact that I realized, you know, there's no prizes when you're in-house for delivering a really complicated summary and showing how clever you are.
Yeah.
You know, the prize comes from making someone else's job, usually your manager, your boss, really easy, because you're summarizing things in a way they can understand. You can append all the technical detail, that's fine, but simplify, allow them to have that key message before they dive into that.
Right. And were you always cut out to be an in-house lawyer?
My mum was a private practice lawyer. She's a corporate lawyer. Right. And my dad, when he was alive, was a lawyer as well. And my mum said, don't be a lawyer.
Right.
But my alternative career options were, you know, at a young age, I looked at being a mermaid, but it didn't seem feasible. And then when I raised being I like biology, and I was interested in, you know, something biology based, but my mum was quick to point out that I might end up studying algae off the coast of Scunthorpe. So having closed off other options, you know, actually the law was an area that I was really interested in as a platform for other things. And I went into it because I actually saw my mum being an incredible career woman and really impressive. And we lived in the countryside, and she used to have these kind of businessmen coming over at the weekends to ask her for advice on their mergers. She did a lot of IPOs and so on. And I just thought she was really impressive.
Yeah.
So I went into the law, partly for a lack of imagination and partly because of that.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah. And you know, she thought the riskiest thing I'd done was to take the step from private practice into in-house work. But now that I'm in-house, actually, I do think I'll stay in the law, because I love the business side of what we do in-house.
Yeah.
And I love that broader work that you get to be across and how you see that business impact of your advice.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, it's good. And it can take you, once you're in that environment, in that business environment, you're advising on risk and risk appetite and other areas which are impactful for the business. So you're looked at as a good operator, hopefully, rather than...
And we have such a purview as lawyers across so many different areas that when it comes to joining the dots, sometimes we have those kind of strategic business insights through the virtue of our function. That's what I really enjoy. And you mentioned being on the executive. That's something I enjoy about being on the executive, actually. Being able to join dots that I'm able to bring together for strategic insights and to help guide some of our decisions just through the virtue of being within a legal team.
And Francesca's mum, your mum of twins.
I am, yes. And they say there's a very special place in heaven for twin mothers, although I did meet a triplet mother the other day, she must be going to even specialist.
Yeah, even higher, even higher. And would you advise your kids to be lawyers? What would your reaction be compared to your mum's?
I think we all just want our kids to be happy, don't we?
Yeah.
We want them to be happy, and hopefully they will just choose something that makes them happy. I do think any profession where you get that training and that discipline is a great platform, whether you stay in it or, like you go into other things. Yeah. Whether you enjoy your private practice years or not, like, a few people would say that it wasn't a good training.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would not close that option off to them, but I would also just hope that they'll find what their passion is.
Yeah, yeah. And we're all on a journey. That's it. It's a journey to get to where you are. So I'd never regret anything, really. But
I'm the same. I don't believe in regrets, just kind of, you know, lesson.
So move on to lesson two.
We talked a bit about Onfido, but to talk about the journey that I've been on with them, I started at Onfido when there were 100 people, and there was only one other lawyer at the time, the general counsel. And we were in this office in Covent Garden, and it was chaos, but it was magic. There was a galley kitchen, people always burning toast. So the whole office smelled of burnt toast. There's lots of developers wandering around with no shoes on, just in their socks. And it was a really exciting time. And my lesson that I learned from joining at 100 people and seeing the business scale all the way up from 1 million in revenue to, you know, over 100 million in revenue, is that as lawyers, you know, to be effective, we need to be more of an airbag than a seatbelt.
Right.
So when I think about the early days on Onfido, I could be pointing out risks in contracts which I did. But the biggest risk was never getting that business from the 1 million to the 100 million. Mm-hmm. You know, not being able to sign the contracts, not being able to ramp, losing out to competitors, not being able to fundraise. And so effectively, you know, as an in-house lawyer, you have to have that real holistic vision on, and everybody talks about commercial awareness. It's a bit of a buzzword, but you really do have to be aware of the very much broader macro environment in which your business is operating in. And sometimes you don't want to hold that growth and that scale back, and you don't want to be a seatbelt, but you do need to build in safeguards and airbags. Whether it's contractually or in the way that you're building your technology, whether it's in your policy documents, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's worth sometimes not blocking things. You know, maybe there's that really thorny, horrible contract, but it was with an enormous logo.
Right.
And that logo is going to bring on other logos, a little bit like, I don't know if you saw the Spotify documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's episode 3, The Law, where they know the playlist, it's called.
Yeah.
And they know that if they sign one record label, that the others will follow. And in that situation, being out on Fido, when we signed our first enterprise bank, for example, you might need to take some different risk positions to get that over the line than you will long term. And you know, it's sort of that understanding the business environment, and as I mentioned, airbag, not a seatbelt.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. Yeah, absolutely. Prior to being on Fido, you were in house at Hewlett Packard.
I was. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it a different approach within the high growth tech, do you feel?
I mean, a very, very different business. They did large outsourcing agreements, which are very complex and very challenging to deliver. And you're absolutely right. Every business is different in its stage of growth, in its products that it's delivering, in the risks that it's able to take, and trying to have your finger on the pulse and understanding the company's strategy. The position that it's in is really important when you're making those risk decisions.
Yeah.
And also bringing in the right stakeholders, because as legal, we can say, this is the risk, this is the potential reward, this is my recommendation. We can steer away from the rocks, but we don't necessarily need to make the ultimate decision, you know, the CEO or somebody else with more of a holistic vision than we might have, who actually has even more information in terms of serious escalations, is the relevant person to make that. And the key difference between Onfido and HP was that Onfido's very small and agile, so we can move pretty quickly. Mm. We could rip up rule books and so on. HP had much more governance. So like they had 2-week governance cycles. They had something called a deal assessments tool. And it was interesting moving to Onfido, because there was elements of best practice there that I wanted to bring over, but I also didn't want to slow down this really fast growth agile company.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to create something completely, completely new. And we've iterated on that over the time as well. Yeah.
But then still the stuff you must have seen at HP with the best practice and what good looks like in a larger organization is, you can hopefully bring those practices over as the business grows at Onfido.
Yes, totally. And at Onfido, what was right for 100 people and 1 million in revenue wasn't right when we were 200 people and 50 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. And then the same again when you in the next iteration. So it's kind of a continual evolution to get to the place that you want to be, which is ultimately when you're a PLC that you got these really well-documented positions. But even at HP, we had to take unusual risk positions to get some deals in.
What did you make of that Spotify series? Isn't that a Netflix series?
I really, really enjoyed it. I think, again, we talked about this recently at my legal offsite with the team, but there's a few attributes of, I think it was Petra, the lawyer there.
Yeah, she had a huge impact on.
She did. And she took on a much broader role than the typical sort of lawyer, which I thought was really interesting. You know, she had an instrumental role in defining their pricing model.
Yeah.
And what they put behind a paywall and the philosophy of access to music for free, but putting the technology and the really sensitive algorithms and the unique selling points of Spotify behind a paywall to drive sustainability of the long-term business.
Yeah.
And she then got the buy-in from the key stakeholders, you know, from the founders, and then went back to the record labels, and then it still wasn't enough. And they wanted a share in the business. And she then negotiated the corporate aspect of that. Mm. She did a lot of ecosystem building.
Yeah, and deal making.
Deal making, yeah. Which
was cool. Actually, I enjoyed that
I did too.
Sort of it. Yes, a huge role. Cool. Is she your lawyer? The aspirational lawyer, fictional or non-fictional?
She's one of, sure.
And outside of tech, I mean, you've obviously had a lot going on recently, but what's your passions outside of work?
So I think probably like many lawyers out there, I went into the law because of love of writing.
Right.
And definitely not recently. I have to admit, I haven't had a creative thought since my twins were born. but prior to my girls who are now two being born, I did a novel writing course at the Faber Academy,
right,
which was just brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And I had actually written one bad book before I did that course and forced, you know, various family members to read it and sort of been told it was not that great.
Right.
So I thought I better go and do, you know, do a course on this if I'm enjoying writing. And so I did it with Wednesday nights and Saturdays, and it was really great. I met some amazing people, and I turned up and I thought, you know, we're just going to have lessons in characterization and how to structure a plot. Mm-hmm. But actually you write a book on the course.
Right.
So at the end, I had sort of finished this book, and you know, it's much better than the first one, that's for sure. And I had a bit of agent's interest, which is great.
Oh, good.
It's something that I'd like to come back to later life, yeah, I think, cool. Writing and creative work. But my husband used to say, it's lonely being married to a writer. Because I'd just go to the library and write this novel all day on Saturday and lose like 6 hours in the world of imagination. So yeah. I think it might be a later life thing for me.
Once the kids are running around, not giving you peace.
Exactly. I'm lucky if I've got time to wash my hair these days. So.
Yeah. I had Abigail Dean, who's she was a lawyer at Google, but she wrote Girl A.
Oh, that's a brilliant book.
Bestseller. So she was a guest on the podcast. Doing good.
It's interesting. There's quite a few writers who are also lawyers on the Faber course. And I know that there's been some amazing novels from lawyers who've just taken like a sabbatical to write them and so on.
Yeah, that's great.
Really impressive.
Well, yeah, definitely. Got to explore the passion, right? And when it's writing and words have meaning as longer. So, you get to flex that muscle when you're drafting or doing contracts.
Totally. But I mean, the weird thing that I would say is you think doing a writing course on an evening and a weekend would make you sort of, you know, maybe a bit depleted for your legal role in the week. But I found it so energizing and it really made me think in a different way. It actually improved my role because I was like using this creative side of my brain that was helping me to approach challenges in my legal role daily in a different way.
We'll move on to lesson three.
Lesson three. Okay. So this one, and this may be slightly influenced by me joining a startup, but I think it's an important lesson, whether you're a startup or not, and that is the power of the network.
Right.
So at Onfido, I worked with a fantastic one of the co-founders, and he was the COO. And whenever I used to go, if we had a question and I used to go away and spend, you know, a big chunk of time researching, he'd say, why don't you just ask your network? I remember thinking to myself, what is this network of which he speaks? You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like 6 years ago now, quite sort of, you know, a lawyer that's come straight out of private practice and then into HP. But then I thought about it. And when I left HP, it was after the big corporate separation, and a lot of the legal team in the UK moved off to Amazon and Google and Expedia and Jitsu and Secret Escapes and these great companies. And they were all experiencing new learnings and similar challenges like around the time of the GDPR coming out as me.
Right.
And so I thought, actually, I do have a pretty good network. Maybe I will just band these questions out. And as lawyers, and I don't want to generalize, we're all different. Everyone's different. But we are kind of an achiever, self-flagellating bunch. And also in private practice, you're taught not to ask questions, but to go and research and find the answer yourself. Mm-hmm. But actually, sometimes it's just way more effective to go to your network and say, you know, has anyone got a template precedent for this? Mm-hmm. Or does anyone have a contact for a law firm in this new geo? Has anyone had any experience with data protection law in this country?
Yeah.
And get that shortcut answer that can save hours and hours and hours.
Yeah. What's been your biggest win from that? And what do you find the best mode of doing that is?
Yeah. So, I mean, the Tech GC is just brilliant. I go to that with so many different questions, and just templates, brilliant templates that you could spend a lot of money on externally, or questions that are not really that law related, but more about, you don't need to know what best practices, you want to know what the industry's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could ask for a data retention schedule and get, you know, four different templates and pick the one that's most suitable for our business.
Yeah.
Or I could ask about approaches to state filings in the US, because we don't have a huge US team, and that it would be something that somebody would know off the top of their head in the US.
Yeah.
Or kind of, you know, for benchmarking, I can get like kind of 20 responses about how people are approaching, for example, evaluation question, and then pick or show the data back to the exec and say, this is how other tech businesses are approaching it. So it's a fantastic network. Yeah. And then obviously just personal network as well.
And how have things been within tech? I think we chatted before recording around like Silicon Valley Bank and all that. How is that impacting on your job for that weekend?
It was, yes. We do work with SVB. And, you know, actually, I was very sad about that. They're such a great, great team, in my opinion. We're actually in the same building as SVB.
Okay.
So I was really glad that they managed to get that deal in place.
Yeah.
We're still working with them. I think it's been an interesting time in tech. We are a B2B provider, and a lot of our customers are fintechs and challenger banks and tech companies, sharing economy companies, and a lot of our customers have had a really hard time, which, you know, flows through.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an interesting time, but it's also, and I love that Warren Buffett quote, it's only when the tides go out that you see who's been swimming naked, you know. What I take from that is that in times of abundance, you know, any company can show incline in growth and do well. And in times of hardship, it's really the winners are often the ones with the discipline, the operational discipline and the infrastructure to be able to survive. I think like any period of downturn, it's like been rich with learning.
That's important, isn't it? And coming out of it stronger. And what's your, on Fido, what's your plans beyond that and next things for you?
Well, I still got a little bit of life in me left on Fido, although I have been there for going on 6 years. So I think in the future, after on Fido, I'd love to move into a similar sector, but a slightly different sector, learn about a new sector. I'm really passionate about ESG.
Right.
Actually, just recently went on a great course run by the Corporate Governance Institute. So being able to work with something that sort of strikes a heart, like a chord, my heart in the sustainability sector or renewable energy sector would be fantastic. Keep an open mind. I think, again, being able to work across different businesses and areas is something that I'd be interested in longer term, and then potentially being a non-exec director is the dream at the same time as novel writing, potentially on the Riviera.
That's so sad.
I won't give up the day job just yet.
Yeah, and mermaiding in your spare time.
Exactly.
Thank you for sharing your lessons. It's been great to learn those and to hear about your journey.
Thank you so much for having me in the hot seat.
It does feel a bit mastermind sat here, doesn't it, with the lights down. And thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed that episode, then there are a host of great guests that we've had over the last four series. Those are available at harrietbrown.com/podcast. A great resource for anyone that's interested in finding out more. So head on over there. I've been Scott Brown. Thanks for listening. See you next time.